My name is Roger Epp. I have the privilege of being dean of this faculty and the privilege of following to the stage our choir. You will hear more of them this afternoon. Let me say, first of all, welcome, and I'll come back to that word in a minute. I also want to say that as I've been thinking ahead to this day, even this morning, I was drawn back to a photograph that was my first introduction to the very idea that there was in Camrose, a place I'd never been, a venerable institution of higher learning. It was a photograph in the Diamond Jubilee, Alberta History, or the book Alberta a Celebration. It was a photograph by Harry Savage, and it was a photograph of Chester Ronning on a winter day with Old Main in the background. That was my introduction to the idea that there was such a place in a city called Camrose. That's the building where I now have an office, and it's the building in which his photograph that I think you would have seen outside normally hangs. Well, today, and in the ongoing life of the center that is named for Chester Ronning, it is Chester Ronning who again connects people to this place across generations and across continents. Welcome to all of you who have come from close by and from far away. I want to say a few particular words of welcome, and I want to start with the Ronning family. There is a large contingent here, but we're happy to have provided an occasion to bring you back. And without introducing you all by name at this point, I'll ask you to stand. Please, all of you who are sons, daughters, grandchildren, please stand, and let's acknowledge them. Those of you who are on this campus for the first time, and there may be some, should know that your family name resonates here, and you will always be welcome. We have distinguished visitors. I would also welcome, and in a way, those distinguished visitors represent different aspects of the life of Chester Ronning. A little later in the program, you will hear from Dr. Carl Amrine, who is Provost of the University of Alberta, the institution from which Chester Ronning received an education degree and later an honorary doctorate. We have distinguished visitors from the political realm. Leroy Johnson, the MLA for Wetaskiwin Camrose, is here. I understand, although I'm not there. There you are, Leroy. It's easier from your point of view to see what's going on than from mine. I don't know if Brian Mason is here. There, Brian Mason, who's leader of the New Democratic Party in this province, and in a way the successor to Chester Ronning, who once led your predecessor party. Welcome. Bill Blakey is here, Member of Parliament, and you will hear from him in just a moment as we accommodate his airline schedule. National Bishop Raymond Schultz of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada is here among us, and we will hear from him as well later. Don't think we have representation from the diplomatic realm except for some regrets. I also want to welcome members of the Hendrickson family, and I'm not sure that I'm going to do well at seeing you either, but Doris Anderson, Joyce Hendrickson are here. And Krista, who is a current student here, and the Hendrickson family is important to the work of the center because it's their generosity that has created an endowment in support of the lecture series, and that is very much appreciated. They have caught the vision for what the center can do. There are other acknowledgments that I think I will make in the course of the afternoon. And I'm going to shuffle my notes here. This afternoon will unfold in a couple of sections, and you won't hear a lot from me in between. We'll mostly allow the program to proceed uninterrupted. But what we want to do this afternoon is recall or maybe evoke an exemplary life, the life of someone some of us knew personally, others secondhand. I said to Audrey Topping yesterday that I think the only thing her father wasn't good at was getting reelected. But just about everything else he tried his hand at, he was amazingly successful at. And one of those skills and interests was choral music, which is a reason for the choir to be here as well. Without further ado, then, I want to welcome you to what is a really important day in the life of this campus, a day for looking back and for looking ahead, and all of those things together as they should be. Without further ado, I will call on Bill Blakey, who was our keynote speaker at the forum last night and who has a plane to catch, to say some words about the center.
Thank you, Roger, and thank you, David, for the invitation, and my apologies to everybody here this afternoon for the fact that I do have to run, but the service in and out of Edmonton isn't what it used to be, so some of you may have noticed from time to time. So if I'm going to get home, I've got to go. About a year and a half ago, there was a new president at the University of Winnipeg, and I went to visit him. He's a former colleague of mine in the House of Commons, and I said to him, you know, what is needed in Canada, and I literally use these words, is some kind of center for the study of religion and public life. And I thought that the University of Winnipeg would be a perfect venue for that. But I didn't know at the time about Augustana College, and I didn't know about Camrose, and I didn't know about the tradition here. I knew about Chester Ronning, but I didn't know that this was also a perfect venue for the study of religion and public life, and certainly when it's being done in memory of and in connection with the life of such a distinguished Canadian citizen, it's all that more appropriate. I can't think of anything more apropos, more needed at the moment than a place where people can get together and develop some expertise, develop some understanding, develop some capacity to help the world, to help the political world not just the political world, to understand what is going on in the life of the religious and how that relates to public life. We will not have peace in the 21st century unless we have peace between religions, unless we have peace between religion and the secular world, and that isn't working all that well at the moment. So I just think that this is a great thing. I'm sorry that I can't stay here to be with you for the duration of the afternoon, but I can't think of anything more appropriate, either in terms of the work of Chester Ronning. I had an opportunity to read the autobiography, and I recommend it to all of you. I don't have the time to point out the parallels between some of the experiences that he had with our neighbors to the south during the Korean peace talks and some of the things that are going on now, but some movies keep repeating themselves. And so I recommend that to you as well. And again, I apologize for having to leave, and I wish you the very best this afternoon. And I know that this center will come to play in a very important part in the life of Canada and perhaps even of the larger world. Thank you very much.
In my time here, it's always struck me that we have not told often enough the story of Chester Ronning, who is the most striking public figure associated with this place throughout its history. And we thought as we worked on the idea of a center, this was mostly the winter 2 years ago, that his was also an exemplary life that would inspire the work of a center in contemporary times. For me, the need to place his name And his story before another generation of staff and students on this campus is an important thing. And then to have that exemplary and rich life inspire the work of the center in a challenging time. I'm going to invite to the podium in succession four speakers who will recall aspects of that life. The only comment I would add in advance of that is that the story is told here. Now, there are various versions that of Chester Awning's exemplary work as a fundraiser, which I'm trying to take to heart. And the story is that he either wrestled or arm wrestled. Which one was it, Gary? Audrey says arm wrestled. The only way to get enough money for hardwood flooring out of a stingy Norwegian farmer out towards Viking was to wrestle him. And he did. So I'm trying to think that one over. We have four speakers in this portion of the program. And the first is really a photo storyteller. And that is Chester Awning's daughter, Audrey, whom I had the pleasure of driving around the region a little bit yesterday, as well as her husband, Seymour, who will also be part of this group. She is an author and a photojournalist. She and her husband now live in New York, but she is also a graduate, a grade 12 graduate of this place, and I think a former member of the choir.
That's right.
So there are many other aspects of her life I could tell you about, but I cut to the important parts, I hope. She will weave her own story, I think, into what she has to show about her father. Seymour Topping is a longtime foreign correspondent with the New York Times and more recently a professor of journalism at Columbia University in New York. I think the two of them have, with their family, lived in just about every major capital of the world over the course of a lifetime. Just to make sure I have this in the right order. Our third speaker is Bertie Fowler, who is well known to those of you from Camrose as I think one of our wise elders. She is editor of the Camrose Booster and is someone whose care for the community and for this place has been a long time. Not only that, she was Chester Awning's secretary a few years ago. And finally, Brian Evans, and I haven't met Brian, too busy before the start of the program. Brian is a professor emeritus of history at the University of Alberta and is working on a biography of Chester Awning. So I'll get off the stage, and Audrey, you can start this group off and then just continue in turn.
Okay. Maybe we can turn the lights down a bit so we get a better picture. Well, on behalf of the Awning family, I would like to thank you for giving this honor to my father. It's very appropriate because his whole life was devoted to learning. And it also, the old saying that a prophet hath no honor in his own home does not apply to Camrose. Although for a while I wondered. Okay, we're all aware of Chester's accomplishments, but I would like to show you how it all began and some highlights of his unique life as a family man, teacher, and statesman. When I collected the old photographs and scanned them into my computer, my problem became what to leave out and still present the essence of his 90 years in 10 minutes. So my husband decided to grant me 2 minutes of his time. So, and I'll talk as fast as I can. All right, now this is Chester's father, Halvor, Reverend Halvor Awning. He was born on a farm in Norway. He was a famous skier in Telemark. And we like to say he brought the Telemark turn to this country. And like his Viking ancestors, he had a thirst for adventure and travel. But unlike them, he was deeply religious. And he, at an early age, he had an urgent call to spread the gospel as a missionary in China. In 1886, after completing his secular education, he migrated to the U.S. and became an American and graduated from the Red Wing Seminary in Minnesota. His sister Thea came with him from Norway and also studied to become a missionary. Together, they traveled around the country to raise funds for their mission. In 1890, the Ronnings went to Radcliffe, Iowa to raise money, and at the church they met Hannah Rorem, the church organist and local school teacher. She was born in Illinois, but her ancestral home is in Norway. Her father built his own seaworthy ship and sailed to America in 1845. Hannah was so touched by Halvor's sermon called China for Jesus that she volunteered to go with the Ronnings to China as a missionary. They crossed the Pacific on the maiden voyage of the largest ocean liner in the world, the Empress of China. Halvor was 29, Tia 28, and Hannah celebrated her 20th birthday as the ship sailed half steam, half sail to Shanghai, which was then a good place for them because it was called the wickedest port in the Orient. They arrived in China during the fall of the last empress, the last imperial dynasty, under the rule of the Empress Dowager Cixi. China was in turmoil. From Shanghai, they sailed up the Yangtze to Hankou, into the heart of an anti-foreign movement later known as the Boxer Rebellion. They were married in Hankou, and thus began their rather legendary story that contains all the elements of the universal battle between good and evil that is still going on today. And if that wedding had not happened on Christmas Eve, 1891, Chester would not have been born, and we would not be here tonight to tell the tale. Their first son, Nelius, was born in Hankou, where they lived for 2 years studying Chinese. While in Hankou, Halvor commuted by junk. We think we've got a problem. By junk, 600 miles as the river winds up the Han River to Fancheng, to establish the first Lutheran mission for the China Inland Mission. In 1893, he brought the family in a junk like this up to the banks of the Han River, and this is the church that grandfather Halvor Ronning built, and it still stands today. Chester was born on December 13, 1894. He was the first son, the first non-Chinese baby in the county of Shangfan. 2 years, wait a minute, this is the right place. Anyway, 2 years later, Alma was born. Where's Alma? There. 2 years later, Alma was born, but Hannah still kept up her missionary work. She founded the first girls' school in Hubei and opened an orphanage for abandoned baby girls. Chester once said, "When our parents were out Christianizing the Chinese, I was in the kitchen being heathenized by the cook." The family had a literate cook and Amma that had worked for the Super Mandarin. Through them, Chester was introduced to the rich world of old Chinese folklore. The Ronning children dressed and talked like their Chinese friends. Here the boys are in the school uniform. Dad said he did not realize until years later that there were any differences, except for the color of their eyes and hair. In 1899, the Ronnings were forced to leave China because of the Boxer Rebellion. Many of their missionaries' friends had already been murdered. They went to Halvor's home in Telemark, where the children learned Norwegian, and then to Hannah's home in Iowa, where they learned Chinese. So they had the three languages that came in very handy when he became a diplomat later. After the Boxer Rebellion, they returned to China and kept up all three languages. Their mother spoke to them in English, their father in Norwegian, and their friends in Chinese. Now, this is the school. When they came back from China and they knew English, the senior boys in grandfather's school all wanted to learn English from Nelius and Chester. They had pamphlets about the American Revolution, so the American boys taught English to the Chinese boys by reading them the Declaration of Independence. And in translation, the Chinese substituted the name of the Empress Dowager for George III and listed her crimes. Dad said later, he said, their parents would never have died to defy the ruler who reigned under the mandate of heaven, but the students wanted to overthrow the Manchu dynasty. They asked Dad not to tell Old Whiskers, Lao Huzi. They called Grandpa Old Whiskers. Reverend Ronning was not aware that as his sons were, that the beginning of the revolution was flourishing in Christian missionary schools, a revolution that continued for 100 years and not only toppled the 2,000-year-old imperial dynastic system, but threw out both the military dictatorship of Chiang Kai-shek and the communist dictatorship of Mao Zedong and turned China into the superpower it is today. Chester's mother died of exhaustion during the famine of 1907. Her tombstone still stands in the yard of the school she founded. When our family went to pay respects to her grave in 1971, I asked the headmaster why they kept the tomb of a Christian missionary in a communist school yard. He replied, because she was a revolutionary too. And in many ways she was, because she founded the first girls' school, and that was a revolutionary idea in China. After she died, Grandpa decided to send Nelius and Chester back to United States. And the whole school, the whole congregation came to see them off. The problem was, whoops, I missed one. No. Anyway, they didn't have any clothes that were foreign clothes, they called them. But the missionaries or the relatives sent them clothes. Before that, they only had the Chinese clothes. And then they went to Shanghai, where, and Dad tells the story, Grandpa took them by train to Shanghai and bought them new hats. They sailed on the USS Mongolia. This is actually an old postcard that Dad sent to his father. Dad wrote on it, he said, when Father left us, or he told me later, he said, when Father left us on the ship, we stood sadly waving goodbye when the wind blew my brand new hat into the Yangtze River. To this day, whenever I am hatless, I see that beautiful hat tossed like an eggshell heading for the Yellow Sea. They arrived in San Francisco shortly after the great earthquake, and then they took a train to Iowa. But their arrival was not what they expected. In school, the American kids teased them and sang songs like Chinky Chinky Chinaman, eat dead rats, chew them up like ginger snaps. And Dad said, later on that night my pillow was wet with tears, and I longed to go home to China where the students were friendly and didn't regard me as a foreigner. It was not until I learned how to drive a team of horses that the children in Iowa accepted me. But we clammed up whenever the teacher asked us about China. A year later, the boys, Nelius and Chester, went to Bardo, Alberta, to meet their grandfather and the rest of the family who had come from China. He said the Canadian students regarded them now as both Chinese and Americans. They became Canadians when the Honorable Frank Oliver offered to naturalize them if Halver would vote for him in the next election. And he did. Oh, there's the band. Then they went to Camrose Lutheran College. And Chester also wanted to get a teacher's certificate at the normal school, but could not afford it. So Dr. Lavick, who was then the president, he was the first president of the Camrose Lutheran College, offered him board and room if he would take charge of the men's dormitory and teach math and agriculture. And they also played in the band. You see, there's Uncle Nelius up in the corner and Dad down in the second row. And after graduation, the boys rode horseback up the now famous Edson Trail to join the rest of the family in Valhalla. Halvor had sold his house in Bardo and led a group of Norwegian settlers in a caravan of sleighs pulled by a group of 40 teams of horses and oxen up the 500-mile epic journey up the Athabasca Ice Trail. That's another story. To the Peace River District, where he established Valhalla Center, which is still there today, and built another church. Now, this is the Ronnings built the first two-story log house in Peace River. Here, Chester stands on a load of logs he brought in. Grandfather in his preacher's hat is up there on the roof. Hey, this is not supposed to be with the... Oh, yeah, anyway. And the house was recently designated as a provincial historical site. Halvor, and then here's Dad proving the land. When in China, Grandpa bought homesteads for his sons in Canada. And here Dad is proving up his homestead, 50 acres. He proved up with on 9 horses. He wanted to become a rancher. But when the war broke out, Neelis and Chester both volunteered. And although their father was a pacifist, he reluctantly agreed to let his sons join the army. After a stint as a sapper in the Royal Canadian Engineers, Chester transferred to the Royal Flying Corps as a pilot. Both survived, although Dad told us the harrowing story about doing a loop during his first solo flight and looking down to realize he had forgotten to fasten his safety belt. During home leave, Chester fell in love with Inga Horty. This is his story. Forgive the animation here. That was, Dad said, I wondered if she would have accepted me for better or for worse if I had not won the bet. Inga owned a Palomino named Florrie, who had a wild 5-year-old colt named Pet. She bet me a kiss that I could not break Pet, and I foolishly accepted. The next part of the story shows us how Chester and why Chester became a top diplomat by working skillfully behind the scenes. Without Inga's knowledge, this is Dad's story. Without Inga's knowledge, I rounded up the horses and isolated the spirited buckskin. I roped him and rode him bareback around the corral until he no longer bucked. I did this for several nights, and then decided it would be a cinch to ride him with a saddle. So I invited Inga to watch. But he fell over. Well, when I mounted Pet, he reared so high that he fell over backwards. I barely scrambled from under him and managed to slip into the saddle as he was getting up. He jumped the fence and burst into a dead run. I let him go until he was all lathered up before I reached to pet him. When he calmed down, I rode back to claim my win. And the next week, they hitched up a team to grandfather's buggy and drove 45 miles to Grand Prairie to get a marriage license. Reverend Ronning performed the ceremony, and the young people of Valhalla gave him a good old-fashioned chivalry. Then Chester went back to war. This was taken on their fourth wedding anniversary. After the war, Chester earned a Bachelor of Science at the University of Minnesota and taught physics in Edmonton, and their first child, Sylvia, was born. The family was about to move to Minneapolis, where Chester had been offered a teaching job, but fate stepped in and took a tragic twist that changed his whole life. His beloved brother, Neelius, died suddenly. He was a geologist and planned to return to China to run the school his parents founded, but while on a geographical survey on Great Slave Lake, a sudden storm overturned his boat, and he drowned. Reverend Ronning, his father, was devastated. To ease his father's pain, Chester changed his whole life plan and took his brother's place to return to China. In 1921, the Ronnings set off on their fateful journey. They arrived during the chaotic warlord period and lived on the edge of danger while Chester and Inga studied at the Peking Language School. There's Sylvia and Mom and Dad on the America, Australia. USS Australia. A fellow student, by the way, of Chester's in at the language school was General Stilwell, whom he knew later in 1945 in Chungking. Chester always had the had a way of climbing the highest point wherever, whenever anything was around. He would climb to the highest point. He always kept up almost a childish wonderment, which is a wonderful thing to keep all your life. Here he is on top of another elephant. This is a 13-foot-high elephant guarding the sacred way to the Ming tombs. Back in Fancheng, from Peking, they went to Fancheng. Here they are riding on the Great Wall. Dad became headmaster of the Hung Wen Middle School that his father had founded. They lived in this old house, the same house that grandfather built. Dad said he had the students were even more active and had a deeper political and social conscience. They remained in China for 6 years. Here's Dad with some of his students in the school in the background. And then because of the Great Revolution in 1927, the family was forced to leave and ordered out of China, and they escaped downriver, just like his father before him. They dressed as, disguised themselves as Chinese peasants, which is not easy to do when you're 6'2" with eyes of blue. they stayed there for 6 years, and there's Sylvia and Alton and Mamie, who were born in China. They escaped during these down the Han River in these junks. This is a picture I took in 1971, but the junks are the same as they were back in the 1890s. There we are, and that's why we came to Camrose. While we were in Hong Kong, while Dad was in Hangzhou, he got an invitation from the college to become the headmaster, to become the principal of the Camrose Lutheran College. And that's how we came to Camrose. And there we are. That's the old house in Camrose. And that's Alton and me and Mamie and our dog, Shep. And there's Harmon, our brother Harmon. He hasn't changed a bit. That's Averill. This is in the back seat. That's the Serval's house. The Serval boys are here today. And this is the choir. Under Dad, Dad was head of the Camrose College for 15 years. His pride and joy was the Camrose Choir, and we call it his first step to Carnegie Hall, where they were last week. Yeah. Now, after the, while he was still at the college, he went into politics. And let's see. In 1932, the United Farmers Alberta asked him to be their candidate to contest a by-election for the Legislative Assembly of Alberta. During his campaign, a supporter told him that his opponents had started a whispering campaign about him. Well, said Dad, what did they know about my dark past? They say you were brought up on milk from a Chinese woman. Yes, said Dad, that kind wet nurse saved my life. Well, said the man, they also say that if that is so, you must be part Chinese, and therefore you can't run in the Canadian election. Well, said Dad, according to that logic, I want you to start a whispering campaign about my opponents. Well, what do you know about their dark past? Well, I have it on good authority, he said, that they were brought up on cow's milk. Dad told that story wherever, at every public meeting, and the audience seemed to appreciate its logic. He won the election, but later he said, I was thrown out on my ear in the next round. There he said, one of his... I don't know if you can read that. Can you read what it says there? One shall not starve in the midst of plenty and is stealing somebody else's ice cream. Okay, and when the war broke out in World War II, Dad joined the RCAF again and became a squadron leader in charge of the discrimination unit of the RCAF intelligence. They worked in cooperation with the Navy and Army units. Because of his knowledge of Chinese and Japanese as a written language, he was able to break the Japanese code and obtain intelligence through cryptanalysis. Our brother Alton followed in his footsteps and joined the RCAF as a pilot as well. He was shipped to England during the Battle of Britain. This is the last photograph of our family in cameras before the war broke us up. After the... you can read the who we are there. And then Dad was then... He was asked by External Affairs to go to China as a diplomat. Here he is presenting his credentials to Nationalist Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. In March 46, Chester raised the first Canadian flag for the first time in Nanking, China. This was during the Chinese Civil War between the Nationalists and the Communists. And Mom, Shereen, Harmon, and I joined Dad in December of 46 and lived at the Canadian Embassy for 2 years. Our family was evacuated by air just before the communist troops came into the city of Nanking, which is then the capital of China, and proclaimed the People's Republic of China. Chester stayed in China, advocating diplomatic recognition until the Korean War broke out. He then became the enemy and left under dangerous circumstances. During that time, he returned to Ottawa as head of the Far Eastern Desk and represented Canada in many international conferences. You see there's Joe and Lai up in the corner and Lester Pearson down there beside Dad. It's sort of small. And from then we went to, Dad was appointed as ambassador to Norway. Those of you who can read Norwegian, this was in one of the papers. That was taken in Oslo. There's Harmon and Shereen. The Queen came to visit them. That's Dad's writing on one of the invitations. Here they are coming with Prince Philip and the Queen out of the... that was the Holland Hotel. And there's Dad escorting Queen Elizabeth, introducing her to the other Norwegians. The Ronnings, Chester was appointed High Commissioner to India and Ceylon. The Ronnings were received with all the pomp and ceremony of a Gilbert and Sullivan opera, but Dad never took that seriously. He was as popular with the Indians as he has been with the Chinese. Here he is walking with the president. There he is with the president of India. And that's Elmer Diefenbaker, who was then the Prime Minister of Canada, right? And Nehru, Prime Minister of India. And there, my mother and father with Nehru. One of his one of Dad's big achievements in India was the Gunda Dam, built with Canadian help. Chester insisted on building houses and schools for the workers' families, and they named it Ronningtown, and it's still there today. There's Prime Minister Nehru. Dad was also a good artist. He was a sculptor, and he made Nehru sat for him while he modeled this head of him. Okay, the Queen and Philip, they also came to India to visit them. And then in March 1966, during the Vietnam War, Lester Pearson, then the Canadian PM, and the U.S. President Johnson asked Chester to go as a special envoy to Hanoi, Vietnam, with a letter to Ho Chi Minh, offering Canada's good offices in starting peace talks with the United States. And Top will tell you the rest of that story. We were living in Hong Kong then, and Dad always stopped on the way to Vietnam and back to Vietnam to stop to to visit us in Hong Kong. And here he is with our pet cockatoo, Charlie. Charlie also spoke Chinese. They would talk together. He called him Grandpa. And there's Mother. Inga Horty died in Camrose in 1967. Besides being a great mother and wife, she was a brave soul and an outstanding artist. She won many prizes for her oil paintings and designed her own hats. This is one of my favorites. Chester was never quite the same after Mom died. After she joined her ancestors, as he used to say. But he carried on bravely, traveling widely, speaking against the war in Vietnam, and advocating recognition of the People's Republic of China. In 71, he accepted a standing invitation from his old friend, Zhou Enlai, the Prime Minister of China, to visit China. And Sylvia and I went along with him. Joe was waiting with outstretched hands at the Great Hall of People to welcome him. And the first thing he said to Dad was, "I'll never forget what you did for me in Geneva." And Top will tell you what he did in Geneva. And so he made headlines. That journey, that return to China made headlines all over. This is Life magazine. I took this picture when he was talking to Dad. And then this was also made a front page story in the National Geographic. Here it says, Ronning was the best show on the road. He met with top leaders in China and old friends he once played with. And they exchanged Chinese riddles and reminisced about chasing patty chickens, which are frogs, in the rice fields 80 years ago. These were friends of his that he'd played with 80 years ago. We returned about 12 times in the 1970s and 80s, and Dad was always happy to be back in China. We visited every province and autonomous region, including Xinjiang, where Dad could not resist showing off and joining in a game of polo with a sheepskin. Shortly before Zhou Enlai died, he introduced us to Chairman Deng Xiaoping, who later said the famous words to the Chinese, "To get rich is glorious," and thus unleashed the Chinese to create the capitalist free enterprise that China is doing or enjoying today. Zhou Enlai died in 76, and this was one of the obits in the New York Times. In 83, the whole family returned with Dad to China for the last time to celebrate his 90th birthday in the town where he was born and to pay his last respects to his mother's grave, which is still there. We visited the Ronning School and were met by throngs of old friends. In Beijing, we stayed at the old house of Chiang Kai-shek, and there was an official dinner in his honor at the Great Hall of People when Minister Wang gave a welcoming toast to him. Dad responded, "Well, I don't know if you're welcoming me or not, because you have put me in the house of your old enemy, Chiang Kai-shek." There was dead silence until Wang laughed and said, "That's because you are friends of both Chinas." So Chester was awarded, six honorary degrees, including the University of Alberta and Simon Fraser, who called him a gifted diplomat, a warm-hearted and dynamic personality, and a natural leader. That's it, folks. Recognize yourself?
Yeah. That's good.
I think Audrey just about told the whole story.
I've been married to her for 56 years, and I've spent most of that time trying to catch up to her. And today is another example of that. Audrey has spoken to you about the roots of the mainsprings of faith, duty, and service, and I'm very pleased to have an opportunity here in her hometown, to which she is so attached and beloved, to talk about that a little more, to take you into the next chapter of the Ronning saga with a few more intimate glimpses and personal notes, but I hope they will give you added insights into why the center will be such a meaningful symbol of devotion in public life. In becoming Audrey's husband, I was twice blessed, first by being warmly welcomed into the Ronning family. Then this family tile yielded me extraordinary opportunities, sometimes as a journalist, to witness Chester's historical service as one of Canada's most distinguished diplomats and a key actor on the world stage. As for the family's tie, it began in Nanking, China, in 1948, on top of Purple Mountain, when Audrey agreed after a year's courtship to marry me. Chester was then minister counselor of the Canadian Embassy, and soon atop another mountain in Kuling, he gave me his treasured blessing, one that has profoundly affected my life, obviously. The Chinese Civil War was on then in full fury, and I was the Associated Press correspondent in Nanking, Chiang Kai-shek's capital. And on the morning of April 24th, 1949, Chester and I stood side by side, alone, watching Chinese communist troops who had stormed across the Yangtze River during the night, entering Chiang Kai-shek's capital, which had been abandoned. Yet another adventure that day, a small adventure. After filing my dispatches about the entry of the communist troops into the city, I had returned to the AP compound, and I was at work there when communist soldiers entered my office, and they were suspicious of my radio transmissions. They put me under house arrest and barred me and my servants from leaving the compound. But the next day, here came Chester all alone, bearing food packages, which he thrust through the bars of the gate at the front of the house. He was not going to let his future son-in-law starve, and I was sort of happy about it because it was proof that he really wanted me to be his son-in-law. Of course, as Audrey has told you, with other dependents, she and other members of the family had already been evacuated by air from Nanking. In a sense, Chester became father to the entire diplomatic community in communist-occupied Nanking. Soon after the occupation, the diplomatic corps was assembled in the Chinese Foreign Ministry, where they listened to a speech by Huang Hua, the representative of the Mao Zedong government in Peking. There was a great deadening silence in the hall after Huang Hua's speech, and then the New Zealand ambassador rose and rather plaintively said, sorry, Huang Hua, we don't understand what you've said. Would you agree to Chester Ronning interpreting for us? And from that day on, Chester became the official link between the diplomatic corps and the Chinese Communist Control Commission. Chester had been friendly with Chiang Kai-shek. He was a guest at his house in Kuling, which is summer retreat from Nanking's unpleasant searing summers, a bronco buster, as you've seen from Audrey's pictures from in the old days in Alberta. Chester was invited by the Generalissimo to ride his spirited Arabian stallion. In 1946, serving in the Canadian Embassy in Chongqing, at that time, Chester was very supportive of the efforts of General Marshall, President Truman's envoy, to bring Mao and Zheng together in coalition government, something that failed. But late in 1949, as the communists took control of the mainland, Chester felt very strongly that Canada should recognize the government of the People's Republic of China, which Mao by that time had established in Peking. He thought that world peace and stability would be best served by bringing 1 billion Chinese into the international community as soon as possible, and history has proven him right. So much of what happened, the Korean War and other things, was a result of China remaining in isolation. On June 25th, 1950, Chester very happily, now chargé d'affaires of the Canadian Embassy, did in fact become instructed by the Ottawa to enter into diplomatic negotiations with Peking for Canadian recognition. But in sadness, as Chester recalled to me, it was too late. On that day, war broke out in Korea. Chester was ordered to close the Nanking Embassy and return to Ottawa, where he became the head of the Far Eastern Department of your government. En route home, he went to Saigon, where I was stationed as the AP correspondent covering the French Indochina War. Audrey had recently given birth to our first child, the first of our five daughters. The child was born in the French military hospital on a night that one of the city's outposts around Saigon was under Viet Minh mortar fire. Chester held our baby, Susan, in his arms and prayed she would know a better world. Through the years, Chester continued to press for Canadian recognition of China. In 1958, he was advised by Lester Pearson, then the Minister of External Affairs, that Canada would recognize Peking, and he would be named, Chester would be named the first Canadian ambassador to China. Shortly before the announcement was to be made, Lester Pearson and Prime Minister Louis Saint-Laurent went to Washington to inform President Eisenhower. And to their surprise, however, President Eisenhower, who was embittered by the Chinese intervention in the Korean War, protested. Chester recalled, recalled later, Eisenhower said other nations would follow the Canadian example and recognition, and this might result in the People's Republic being admitted to the United Nations. If China was ceded, the president warned that the United States would withdraw from the United Nations. And so it was not until October 13th, many years later, 1970, that Canada finally was able to recognize China, and counting the days, in retrospect, Chester said it was 21 years and 13 days after he made his initial recommendation. Chester not only laid the foundation for the vital bridge to China, but he was a peacemaker in other Asian conflicts. Typical of this was his role at the Geneva Conference on Indochina in 1954. It was a time when French troops in Indochina were collapsing under the onslaught of the Viet Minh, Ho Chi Minh's forces. Chester was at Geneva as the head of the Canadian delegation, and I was covering the conference for the Associated Press. It was a critical juncture in history, since Washington was considering intervention, possibly even the use of a nuclear weapon to relieve the Viet Minh siege of Dien Bien Phu and to block Ho's takeover of the country. At the opening, in the first day of the conference, it was a formal reception. And John Foster Dulles, the American Secretary of State, entered the hall, closely followed by Chester. Dulles was greeted within the hall by the outstretched hand of Zhou Enlai, the Chinese foreign minister and head of the delegation. But Dulles turned his back, spurn the outstretched hand of Zhou Enlai. A shocking loss of face for the Chinese, except that Chester leaped forward and grasped Zhou Enlai's hand. It was a moment that sealed a lifelong friendship between the two men and allowed Chester to act as a liaison to the Chinese people at a time when the United States was refusing to recognize the People's Republic. The Geneva Conference averted for a time a wider war in Indochina that might have involved the Soviet Union and China. But then once again, in 1966, when the United States was battling Ho Chi Minh's forces, Chester was called upon once again as ambassador at large to perform as a peacemaker under the code name Operation Small Bridge. Chester was asked by Ottawa, with the agreement of the United States, to undertake a secret mission to Hanoi designed to bring the United States and North Vietnam together in peace negotiations. As Chester traveled to Hanoi at the time, Audrey was in Peking as a correspondent for the New York Times, covering the onset of the Cultural Revolution. I was then en route to Bangkok from Laos, where I'd been covering the war for the New York Times. I learned of Chester's mission, and I arranged to meet him in Bangkok. He was returning from Hanoi, and he was returning a very sad and very disappointed man from this, his second visit to Hanoi. On the first visit to Hanoi, the North Vietnamese had agreed to enter into negotiations if the United States would unconditionally halt the bombing of the North. In reply, President Johnson imposed a condition that the North Vietnamese should cease all assistance of any kind, economic, military, of any kind, to their allies, the Viet Cong in the South. As Chester expected, when he returned to Hanoi, the North Vietnamese rejected the American demand. After that meeting in Bangkok, I recorded that rejection, which shocked a lot of people, on the front page of the New York Times. On March 31st, 1968, some 1 year plus, recognizing that the North Vietnamese could not be defeated, and to induce them to negotiate, Johnson ordered a halt to the bombing of North Vietnam. Essentially, Johnson had accepted the terms brought back by Chester from Hanoi in March 1966 in the first of his two missions. Johnson, after that initial announcement, on April 3rd, declared that Hanoi had agreed to meet the American representatives. However, in that interim between the meeting which finally took place and the moment in history when Chester brought back the offer from the North Vietnamese, many thousands of Vietnamese and American soldiers had died in the fighting. I related only a few personal recollections of historical chronicles in the life of Chester Ronning as he struggled for the betterment of humanity. In the abundance of his spiritual and public life, at the center, students will find unending inspiration as they recall his life. Thank you very much.
I'm one of the more fortunate persons here this afternoon, because I actually knew Chester Ronning as a real live person. I remember him as my first employer over 65 years ago. I remember him also in later years as a friend. Someone referred to him as my boss, but that's not an appropriate title. Chester Ronning was never a boss. Even as an employer, he was a teacher, a mentor, but never a boss. Chester Ronning was tall. He was handsome. He stood unusually erect with his shoulders back and his chin up. He was always dignified, and he stood out in any crowd. He was a man of a rare combination of qualities. He was quiet, gentle, soft-spoken, and yet he was always the respected commander. He greeted each morning with good humor, eager and ready to face the challenges of the day. The room lit up when he arrived, and there was always a contagious aura of confidence that emanated from him. And I must add that in real life, I never ever saw Mr. Ronning as stern as he appears in the formal pictures that we've seen today. The man that I remember was like the candid you saw, always smiling, always some kind of action in it. That's the Chester Ronning I remember. Now, while I was Chester Ronning's secretary during his tenure as premier of, principal, of Camrose Lutheran College, which was Old Main, as I can see it out the window right now, and that's all there was on the entire 40-acre campus. I observed Chester Ronning as an educator, administrator, as a choir director, a family man, and a politician. And this afternoon, I will keep my remarks within the context of religion and political life, which will be consistent with the mandate of the Ronning Center. Chester Ronning lived with positive intent. His life had purpose, and his mission was to serve and to be a leader as required. He evangelized by example, by living his faith, more than preaching it, although he could do that too. I feel most fortunate that he was my very first employer, because he taught me at a very early stage in my adult life valuable lessons that have influenced the rest of my life. He demanded excellence, but in a kind, gentle, empathic way, quietly explaining to me that every letter, every response to a telephone call, every encounter within or without the office portrayed an image of the institution that we represented. And by so doing, he made me realize that even in my comparatively insignificant job, that what I did was important, and that even I could make a difference. And that was the tactic he used to inspire his faculty, his students, and all with whom he came in contact. He was a great ego booster. At that time, the college was a residential high school offering courses grades 9 to 12, plus a post-secondary business course. Now, most of the students were from rural areas who had never been away from home before. Ronning understood their unease at being in a strange place and among strangers. In the opening day of General Assembly of Students and Teachers, he would welcome these teenagers, some as young as 14. And in an enthusiastic, warm, and a fatherly way, he told them that he and the faculty members realized that it would take them a few days to become accustomed to their new environment, but he had every confidence that they could do it well and they could do it quickly. And the fact that he believed in students inspired them to do so. Who could disappoint the man that believed in you? Students liked and respected him, and he inspired them to be the best they could be. Chester Ronning was idealistic, but he was pragmatic as well. And I recall a chapel period in which he spoke about prayer. He cited the example of being caught in a building that was on fire. Now, I interpreted what he said to mean that in such a circumstance, one would not first fall on your knees and ask the Lord to get you out. You would use the God-given gifts of intelligence and physical ability to get yourself out. And by extension, there was a message there that would apply to difficulties throughout one's life. Chester Ronning was a compassionate man, so it was natural that when he entered politics that he represented the party which he believed to serve the people in greatest need. And in the years of the Great Depression, in the dirty 30s, that was deemed to be farmers and the unemployed persons who stood by the hundreds in line for food at soup kitchens all across the country. As a sideline, I did his political stenography and I took some notes at his public appearances. He moved with ease and dignity on the public stage, and he spoke with sincerity and conviction, and there was a wonderful picture that Audrey had. We met the mic, his hand up, and I could just hear that velvety voice. I was going to tell the story about the Chinese woman's milk, but Audrey did it so beautiful, we can skip that. I understand that later, when Chester Ronning was called out of retirement to negotiate in various tense and delicate situations involving Korea, Vietnam, that it was his unique ability to ease tensions and that made negotiations even possible. He became widely known as an expert in Asian affairs. As I followed his career as a diplomat, I often recalled another verse of scripture that Mr. Ronning had used in a chapel break at Camrose Lutheran College. And it was this: Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. It often occurred to me that those words could also have described the life of Chester Ronning. I said at the beginning that Mr. Ronning evangelized by example, by living his faith more than preaching it. Throughout his life, he said yes to difficult assignments because he was ready and willing to serve wherever he was called, even to places where safety was indeed tenuous. I believe it was his faith that made him accept and go forward with confidence. In spite of his international renown, moving in circles of kings, queens, presidents, persons in high places, he was never pompous or arrogant. In retirement, he chose to return to what he called his humble family home in Camrose. And he renewed his acquaintances here just as if he had never been away. In the sunset years of his life, he said, "Live until you're old. Learn until you're old. And still there is so much left to learn." Until his body wore out, he never stopped living and learning. Mr. Ronning was later Dr. Ronning by virtue of a number of honorary degrees. As my very first employer over 65 years ago and later as a friend, I remember him with fondness, respect, grateful for having personally benefited from his mentorship, kindness, and friendship. It is most fitting that the Venerable Dr. Ronning be memorialized with the establishment of the Ronning Center and the mandate which will guide its direction. It is my earnest hope that it will be more than a symposium out of which comes declarations of understandings among adherents of the world's great religions. It will be all for naught unless understandings actually lead to more peaceful coexistence among all the world's peoples. That would be the most fitting memorial for Chester Ronning, who intentionally lived his faith by bridging gaps among people of different races, cultures, and beliefs. I extend my very best wishes for the success of the Ronning Center.
Good afternoon. History may repeat itself, but as a historian, I'm a firm believer that one should not repeat what has been said so ably by those before him. So you'll pardon me if I edit my remarks, because at the moment they begin to resemble a bit like a Swiss cheese. However, it's a pleasure and an honor for me to participate in this opening ceremony of the Chester Ronning Center. Ronning is a hero of mine. I had the privilege of knowing him during the latter two decades of his life. At times, we appeared together at teach-ins when the subject was Vietnam or China, and he generously gave guest lectures in my course at the University of Alberta on the history of China. In addition, I spent many hours interviewing him in his house on the edge of this campus. I might say that when he gave his guest lectures in my course, He started with the Taiping Rebellion in the mid-19th century and took the whole sweep of Chinese history up to the triumph of the communists and the consolidation of the regime. He was so hypnotizing to the class that many of them left, I think, thinking he had fought with the Taipings, that he had been with Mao, and that he so lived Chinese history. David Goa suggested that I talk about Ronning's transition from politician to diplomat, and that I should do this in a brief compass of time. I'll do this, but obviously not the last word is being said. Chester Alvin Ronning was a person of tremendous talents that were only partly on display in three of his many careers: teacher, politician, and diplomat. He was multilingual, English, Norwegian, and Chinese, to name but three, eloquent and witty in them all, tall, handsome, with a thick head of hair that turned in later life to a silver gray, sparkling eyes and a ready smile, he always had complete command of an audience. Fate decreed that his life was to be guided by cataclysmic events in the land of his birth, China. As we've heard, he had to leave as a young boy from China because of the Boxer Revolt, and again later when he returned with his young family in the 1920s, he had to return in 1927 in the face of the Northern Expedition, the growing war between the communists and the nationalists, and the growing xenophobia that marked China at the time. He was to return to China 18 years later, in the fall of 1945, flying over the hump to Chongqing, this time as a newly minted diplomat. So how did he get from here in 1927 to there in 1945? As principal of Camrose Lutheran College, Ronning had a position that commanded respect within the community. He set about expanding enrollment, recruiting good teachers, and teaching math and music. Under his direction, the college choir won provincial awards with great regularity. Politically, his sympathy was with the United Farmers of Alberta, partly because he had been a farmer in his youth and because it avowed progressive policies of which he approved. When the Camrose seat in the provincial legislature fell vacant, Ronning was persuaded to run in the by-election of October 1932, which happens to be my birthday. He was successful, and in so many other duties, he added to those of the, his other duties, he added those of the MLA. His term as MLA lasted 2 months short of 3 years. He proved to be a commanding and persuasive speaker, very active in the work of the UFA government. At the same time, he was attracted by the CCF movement, which, along with social credit, was demanding the attention of Albertans. It was that time in Alberta, before the discovery of vast amounts of oil, when voters faced with economic depression, drought, locusts, and dust bowls were open to non-traditional approaches. In the election of the summer of 1935, the UFA lost, and Ronning with them, as the majority of voters opted for the social credit and the offer of funny money. Thereafter, the UFA withdrew from politics, with parts of it morphing into the Alberta base for the newly founded Canadian Commonwealth Federation, the CCF. Ronning was elected as the first leader of the Alberta CCF party, charged with organization and recruitment, a task he undertook with energy, enthusiasm, and conviction. This meant even more time away from his home, holding meetings throughout the province with speech after speech outlining the party platform and seemingly endless letters to newspapers expounding and defending the party's goals. Anyone who doubts Ronning's socialist credentials should read these letters. All Ronning's efforts, however, failed to secure even a seat for himself. He lost under the CCF banner in March 1940 and once again in a by-election 2 years later. Ronning's active political career was nearly over, but not quite. As though he was not busy enough, Ronning had enrolled for a master's degree in education at the University of Alberta, gaining approval for his thesis on the history of the Camrose Lutheran College in 1942. Once again, events in Asia reached out to give a new direction to his life. Ronning had joined the Air Force during World War I, but by the time of the outbreak of World War II in Europe, he was beyond the age limit for active service. Then came Pearl Harbor, an event that might be described in current Bush White House parlance as justifiable preemptive strike. The Canadian government searched for persons with skills in Asian languages. Ronning was inducted into the RCAF with the eventual rank of squadron leader as the head of an intelligence unit and charged with decoding Japanese communications. He took leave of absence from the Camrose Lutheran College and took up residence at the YMCA in Ottawa. When he arrived in Ottawa, he was known primarily to the leadership of the federal CCF, but he soon gained notice in wider circles. For 2 years, he lived in the Y, ate in a good Chinese restaurant, and networked with old Asia hands. Before his family was able to join him in May 1945, as war in Europe ended, and it looked like the war in the Pacific would not last many longer, Ronning once again ran for office as CCF federal candidate for Camrose in the election of June 1945. Campaigning from Ottawa as a member of the armed services was difficult, and perhaps it's not surprising that Ronning did not make it. His political career, as good as over, there remained to him the option of returning to Camrose Lutheran as principal once the war in the Pacific had ended. But it was not to be. China once more took a hand in Ronning's life. Just how that happened was the occasion for another of his favorite stories. In 1942, and for the first time, Canada and China exchanged recognition. A year later, the Canadian legation in Chongqing was raised to the level of an embassy under Ambassador General Victor Wentworth Odlum, who had served in both world wars and who, as a BC liberal, was chosen for the task. The embassy was small, and Odlum, who had an inordinately high regard for rank, felt that he could neither confide in nor discuss matters with its junior members. The embassy needed a more senior staff member, fluent in Chinese. Ronning was asked to vet the Chinese language skills of the three candidates for the job. He tested each of them and failed all three. Perforce, he was asked to accept the post at rank of first secretary, a level with which Odlum could feel free to communicate. Moreover, Ronning was a fellow military man. In the context of the times, Ronning's appointment was extraordinary. He was approaching the age of 51, rather advanced to begin a diplomatic career. He was a specialist when the Department of External Affairs had a strong preference for generalists. He was an outsider. From the West and from American Lutheran mission stock, he was not from the Ontario Golden Triangle, from which the department recruited mish kids from Canadian Methodist and Presbyterian Church missions, who had the common experience of summers in Baie-d'Aix and studies at the Kobe Academy. Other department members were likely to be Rhodes Scholars. Ronning's degrees were from Minnesota and U of A. Why do papers stick? He flew to Chongqing in the fall of November 1945 to take up his position. But it's a tribute to his natural diplomatic ability that he was able to swim in this pond with all these other selected people from Central Canada. He proved himself so able that not only was he to become a famous diplomat, but he also, wonder of wonders, was able to follow a specialist career, a specialized career in Asia within a department. Specialized except for Norway, which was a logical appointment in his case, but not so odd because while he was appointed at Norway, the conferences on Indochina and Vietnam took place, and he was there as a senior leader of the Canadian delegation. Other details of Ronning's diplomatic career have been outlined and commented upon, except to say that it was extraordinary, including postings to India, Indochina Commission, along with two post-retirement special missions to Hanoi. I will, however, align myself with the comments of the Australian diplomat Sir Walter Crocker, who wrote in an unpublished essay on Ronning, "His government made some, but not much use of his knowledge. In some respects, it distrusted his knowledge because it clashed with their policy or prejudices or with those of the United States." Without doubt, as the Cold War deepened, Ronning's socialist political background made some members of the Department of External Affairs nervous, and his opinions, along with those of at least two other like-minded members of the department, were likely discounted. In the early months of 1951, at the end of his first diplomatic posting, Ronning had to close the Canadian embassy in China, which had relocated with the Chinese nationalist government to Nanjing after the war. By now, the communists were in control in the Chinese mainland, yet the Canadian government was reluctant to proceed with recognition of the New People's Republic of China. It was a sad ceremony for Ronning to perform. From then on, within the Department of External Affairs, and after he retired from it in 64, he was a tireless advocate for recognition of China. He was the obvious ambassador in waiting, waiting to return to the land of his birth, representing the land of his adoption. But it was not to be. Recognition did not come until the 13th of October, 1970, much to the 75-year-old Ronning's great joy. He had played an important role in Canadian recognition, and he was also to have a hand behind the scenes in the warming of relations between the United States and China, marked so dramatically by Nixon's trip to Beijing 34 years ago. After recognition, Ronning returned a number of times to China and was received with honor at the highest levels. At home here in Camrose, his house became a place of pilgrimage for every Chinese ambassador, Chinese delegation, and every Chinese student who could make it to visit with Ronning, to listen to his stories of old China, delight in his Hubei accent, and above all, to be photographed with him. He received many accolades, among them the highest civilian honors that this country and this province can award, Officer of the Order of Canada and a member of the Order of Alberta. I venture to say in conclusion that Ronning shone more brightly as a diplomat than he did as a politician. I say so because I detected in him a longing to bring harmony and balance to his world, a worthy goal in keeping the precepts of Chinese philosophy, a goal more readily achieved through diplomacy than through partisan politics. As conductor of the Camrose Lutheran Choir, he proved adept at bringing forth harmony from discordant voices, a talent that he demonstrated in spades as a diplomat. Thank you.
been a long afternoon and a full afternoon, and we are close to a reception, which is set up behind you out these doors. I think the remainder of the program can flow again without my involvement, and the last part of it will require you to usher yourselves out and mingle for as much as you can remain this afternoon. I hope you have received this brochure, which will give you more information about the contemporary work of the Ronning Center and even gives you an opportunity to support that work. I know you've probably paid attention to that already. The Ronning Center is the work of a lot of people. I want to single out David Goa. We are happy to have leading this work, and Dietmar Mundell, a professor here who was interim director in the first year and continues to have a role in the operations of the center, as does an advisory board. But the idea of the center took shape really 2 years ago, over the year in which we were negotiating a merger or a transfer of Augustana University College to the University of Alberta, and became an important item for the board of Augustana University College at that time. There were lots of people involved, lots of minds, lots of drafts, lots of conversations, and I will call to the podium now two people who were part of that process. One of them is the provost of the University of Alberta, Carl Amrine, and the other is Bishop Raymond Schultz. So in that order.
Thank you, Roger. My original position in the program was a little bit higher, and that was the expected sequence. As a result, the bureaucracy that Augustana has come to know so well equipped me with all that I was supposed to say. However, since the program has been changed, I now stand before you with no protection from my Edmonton bureaucracy, so I'm just going to have to wing it a little bit. Augustana has a very special place in my heart. My first meal in my current position took place in the cafeteria of Augustana. I can report, as you will soon find out, the best food in the University of Alberta, all campuses included, is right here in Augustana. My task is to tell you what a Canadian center is. I'd also like to tell you about a Canadian center at Augustana faculty. It's been a busy 2 years for Augustana faculty, but none of this would have happened without the help of the provincial government. So I'd like to acknowledge Leroy Johnson, who has been an unstinting and very aggressive supporter for Augustana faculty with his colleagues in the government. We've just had provincial budget week, and once again, the government of Alberta has made a spectacular investment in post-secondary education. Last year's budget was an amazing budget, hard to imagine being repeated. This year's budget was even more amazing, even compared to last year's budget. So I would like to thank Leroy and all of his colleagues in government. Other events that set the stage for this wonderful celebration this afternoon is that we have appointed the first dean of Augustana faculty, and that is our own Dean Roger Epp. Roger has shown great wisdom and extraordinary patience as the university has sorted through its selection process. There was an international application process. There was a selection committee of community leaders and campus colleagues. And Kathleen, if we knew the voice you had, we would have started every one of those many, many meetings with an aria, I am sure. But I would like to acknowledge the involvement of all of the community leaders and the academic colleagues in what has to be the singular achievement of the past year, the appointment of our founding dean. We have signed an agreement with East Central Health that will play an important role as the Ronning Center undertakes its academic mission. And, of course, perhaps not so related, but I just can't avoid saying, Augustana Choir in Carnegie Hall is just hard to imagine, and we will be celebrating that choir's performance at the university level in September. So the stage is set. What is a Canadian center? As you heard with great eloquence by many speakers this afternoon, the world is an incredibly complicated place. my belief and the belief of most of us who make the universities our careers, is that the university is the safe place in this complicated world in which extraordinarily hard questions can be explored. In fact, it is our obligation to explore these extraordinary hard questions, even though we know at the outset that some of the answers that we may land upon will be deeply offensive to some of the stakeholders in this world. We have a debate about the role of academic freedom compared to free speech. The difference for me is that academic freedom does not allow you, does not permit you the luxury of wondering how your answers will be heard by other people. Free speech requires that, academic freedom does not. My view is that the modern university is the only place and the best hope in this complex world for shedding light on these hard questions. What is a Canadian center? The University of Alberta and Augustana faculty is built on the German model, where departments are perhaps viewed as vertical pieces brought together to form the university. A Canadian center in the tradition of our university's system is this horizontal slice across these departments that bring together the many people who bring to bear their academic training, their intelligence, their wisdom on these extraordinarily hard questions. Perhaps no place in the modern world that we face today is a center more aptly positioned to address these hard questions than will be the Chester Ronning Center. It is the vortex of all that the Chester Ronning Center will have to deal with that challenges all of us in this increasingly and incredibly complex world to make progress towards the peace that we heard so much was the focus of Chester Ronning's life. I'm perhaps the first speaker that never met Chester Ronning. I was in the coal fields of Pennsylvania when he was doing his academic work. My life is not the better because of that. However, I'm privileged to have the opportunity to hear so much about Chester Ronning today, and I am incredibly proud that the University of Alberta Augustana faculty has chosen to enshrine the legacy of Chester Ronning in naming this center after him. So thank you all for coming this afternoon. We expect great things from Augustana faculty as the first faculty the university put together in many, many years, and I have no doubt that under the leadership of Dean Epp, we will not be disappointed. Thank you.
You've been sitting a long time. Why don't you stand up and take a 30-second stretch? I originally wrote a 30-minute speech and then was told that I only had 10 minutes. So what I've done is taken every second and third line out of my text. So if it doesn't quite hang together, you'll understand why. Anyway, thank you for inviting me to speak. The topic that I've been given is a legacy for the life of the world. Canadians are shocked this week that Abdul Rahman, who is a citizen of Afghanistan, might be facing a death penalty for having converted to Christianity 14 years ago, an act that is illegal in Afghanistan. And our church leaders, some of them, and some of our political leaders have expressed outrage and have said that someone should not be sentenced to death merely for converting from one religion to another. But I was present last night, and I listened to Bill Blakey talking about the disinterest in Christianity that he finds on Parliament Hill. And I thought to myself, well, in Afghanistan, they take Christianity seriously. This is Lent on the Christian calendar. Abdul Rahman is willing to be executed for his faith in Christ. Jesus predicted on his own voluntary journey to execution that he was going to Jerusalem to die. And he met with the objections of his disciple Peter, who said that it shouldn't be so. And Jesus' answer to Peter on the occasion of that objection was that Peter was using the words of Satan. Those same Canadians who are objecting to the actions in Afghanistan, on the other hand, would not want another government interfering in our courts, as our courts would try to determine whether Muslim lesbians should be allowed to marry. See, this is a much more complicated issue than just some feeling of disgust over state brutality. See, there is no separation in Afghanistan between the sacred and the secular, between church and state. The religious and the political parts of the culture are melded together. Afghanistan is a pre-modern society. It's fought endless wars against Western invaders. It exhibits a historical version of Islam that doesn't consider executing a religious traitor a social aberration. In the meantime, Western history has proceeded through the modern period and into the era that some people now call postmodernism. And postmodernism is very pluralistic and claims to be incredibly tolerant, except it does not tolerate the specific. And so postmodernism thinks that converting from one religion to another ought to be a choice as easy to make as changing life insurance companies. But for another perspective on this issue, I turn to Ivan Illich, an old sage that's sometimes forgotten these days, who's had some of his most recent thoughts collected in a book written by someone who interviewed him. It's called The Rivers North of the Future. And Illich says that in spite of our so-called separation of church and state, Western culture is really the outcome of the church. It's a distorted form of Christianity, but it is a form of the church that has paved the way for current globalized economics and for our ecological disinterest in the welfare of the world. It was the outcome of the church sharing power with the Empire of Constantine. Bureaucratic institutionalization within it led the church to emulate the state and then to bless the state and all of the imperial powers of the Middle Ages. And eventually, into the modern period, Adam Smith emerged and capitalist economics, and it came onto the stage of world history like a new religion. He even used that kind of language. So we have to understand that when the American government attempts to bring so-called democracy into Iraq, the Arab nations don't see that only as an attempt by a foreign power to interfere with their sovereignty. They also see it as an interference with their state religion as well. It is not that humanity is lacking in the Middle East. Just recently, a Christian peacemaker team was taken hostage and then released. Most of the people who advocated for their release were Muslims. And they were Muslims who traveled there from all over the world, including Canada. Many of us recognize that the intractability of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund are at least as rigid and at least as death-dealing as the Sharia law that we're reading about in Afghanistan. See, religion is as much a cultural construct as ethnicity is. You know, we always make jokes, if you're Norwegian, you must be a Lutheran. But if you're a Lutheran, you're a culture too, even if you're Scottish. Religion requires a structure from which to portray itself. You know, you have to have some sort of a plan for how you say the things you say. You need a stage, and that's what culture does. And except for the Eastern Orthodox, Western religion has always used the stage of Western thought. And that's how it rationalizes its doctrines and its practices. And there have always, at the same time, been dissidents. But many of those dissidents were judged to be heretics, and it was the main line of Greco-Roman thought that shaped the world that most of us Christians today take for granted. And so religion can become a way for some people to feel that they're going to control the outcomes of God a God who they don't like, because this God is way too free for human competitors. And so for some people, religion degenerates into telling God how to be God. In the meantime, what ticks them off is a God who is free does what God wants. God shows up when God wants and doesn't when God doesn't want to. God forgets. If you go to the book of Genesis and read the story of Noah and the flood, the story ends with a rainbow being put in the sky. The rainbow's not there for our benefit, even though it's pretty. It's there to remind God not to destroy humanity again. So it's a little arguing point for the Jewish people that every time the meek do not inherit the earth and the poor are doing worse, that you can go and nag God that things are not going the way God promised they should be. That's the kind of God that Jesus inherited. It's a God who's a little bit wild and woolly. But religion can degenerate into trying to tell God how to be God. But God does what God wants, and the trick is in developing the eyes to see and the ears to hear. This is essential to the prophetic enterprise that you were talking about last night. You know, Illich says that in he did this Middle Ages history of how the senses were understood. And before people understood the physics of light, they didn't perceive seeing as light coming into your eye. They understood it as vision going out from your eyes and interpreting what you were seeing. And if you take that image and then hear Jesus saying, "Let those who have eyes to see, see," then it means that you let yourself start seeing the world the way God sees it and not the way you want to see it. Many people welcome postmodernism, but postmodernism is not going to be able to help us. It doesn't allow any values to be put ahead of any other values. It is intolerant of anything. It is tolerant of everything except one thing, specificity, and therefore it is actually intolerant. But how will plurality help us to determine the rules by which human cloning or patenting of life forms should be countenanced or not? How will plurality help us to determine whether halting the pandemic of AIDS is a higher value than the patent rights of pharmaceutical corporations? How will plurality, which acknowledges the existence of all possibilities, help us to sort out those possibilities that do not advance the humane purposes of the world? How does pluralism even go about deciding what it is that is humane? So we need something other than this postmodern world. So I heard a presenter at the World Council of Churches 9th Assembly in Brazil a couple of weeks ago, and he spoke about a transmodern world. And in a transmodern world, there is the possibility of mobility and sharing of cultural and religious ideas across historical and ideological boundaries. A world in which values can be held, specific values that don't even allow for some others but are very specific, but where values can be held, where these values can be expressed, and there is no need to absorb them, to reject them, or to trivialize them as being no different from everybody else's values. Now, that kind of a world is never going to exist unless the poet and the neuropsychologist and the politician and the novelist and the physician and the historian and the mathematician and the playwright and the priest and the child will all sit down together. This is just the Hebrew prophet Isaiah's vision of the peaceful kingdom in a contemporary image. In his own words, he wrote, "The wolf shall live with the lamb, and the leopard lie down with the kid. The calf and the lion and the fatling together, and the little child shall lead them. And the cow and the bear shall graze, and their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put its hand on the adder's den. They will not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. That's the legacy that I want to see lying before us. A legacy that doesn't have to be brought forward from the past, but that calls to us from the future. Thank you.
But we have a ways to go yet.
Okay, give us the key. Now softly, softly, follow my dad.
Once more,
the harmony.
Ready?
Praise you, my Lord, we almighty.